Escape the spotlight of the Latino Media Collective. The Latino Media Collective delivers consequential coverage from the biggest countries in South America to the smallest enclaves of Central America and the Caribbean, and is available on SoundCloud, iTunes Podcast, and Google Play Music. The Latino Media Collective is recorded in WPFW Studios and airs Fridays at 1 p.m. on WPFW Washington.
This is Rev Yearwood, and I am so excited to announce our new climate show, Think 100% Climate Friday. This show will keep you up to date on everything climate justice related in a rapidly changing world. We will discuss breaking news and updates on environmental issues, the climate crisis, COVID-19, and politics. This show will make tangible how the climate crisis is already impacting our lives and what you can do about it. So tune in every Friday at 9 o'clock a.m. right here on WPFW 89.3, your jazz and justice station.
Greetings. WPFW is pleased to announce the relaunch of our major donor program, now known as the Jazz and Justice Circle. If you gave $1,000 last year or so far this year, you are automatically enrolled in this cherished group of listener members, and we thank you. Benefits of your membership are at wpfwfm.org under the Support Us tab at the top of the homepage is the Jazz and Justice Circle. Interested in joining this select group? Please consider a donation of $1,000 or more online at wpfwfm.org. Your donation helps WPFW build a better world one broadcast at a time.
This is Baba Ize, your WPFW programmer of the 6 p.m. Thursday weekly liberatory educational show, hashtag You Must Learn. I'm inviting you to join us this Thursday, August the 19th, from 5 to 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for a special two-hour radio show that will feature experts and educators as we explore critical race theory, CRT. What is it? Why is it causing an uproar, and what you can do about it? So join us this Thursday, August the 19th from 5 to 7 p.m. Be there. Peace.
Hi, I'm Renee Bowser, a staunch trade unionist and host of a new WPFW program, Unionism Drives Community, airing Thursdays at 5 p.m. We will share the importance of knowing your rights in the workplace, the impact of unionism on working class advancement beyond the workplace, and how unionism can activate robust community among all of us. That's Unionism Drives Community, Thursdays at 5 p.m. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Welcome to Community Watch and Comment for Tuesday, June 24th. I'm Dave Raven. Sorry for the delay. We're having some technical difficulties. Later in the show, D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser has set a July 15th deadline for the D.C. Council to give a preliminary approval for the Washington Commanders RFK Stadium project. There's opposition to the deal, including from a group called Homes Not Stadiums. We'll speak with the group's treasurer, Adam Eidinger. But first, there appears to be a ceasefire between Iran and Israel, although by the time the show is airing, this could be a dead deal. This after President Trump subjected the United States to untold consequences with his attack on Iran Saturday night. He did it without congressional approval as required by the Constitution of the United States. And joining us to give some historical context to all of this is American University history professor Dr. Peter Kuznick, co-author along with Oliver Stone of The Untold History of the United States. Dr. Kuznick, welcome to Community Watch and Comment, and welcome callers 202-588-0893. Are you with us, Dr. Kuznick?
Hi, David.
Great. Great to have you. So there's a Chinese curse. May you live in interesting times. It sure seems to apply to our current state of affairs.
Yeah, a little too interesting for my taste.
As close as you can get to the mic, we would be most appreciative. Bad hearing on my end, and appreciate it. Before we get into the current weeds, there's a certain irony here. The United States is intimately involved in the creation of both Iran and Israel. If you could touch on that for a moment.
On the creation of Iran, I would have to take issue with you because Iran is a very ancient civilization. And it's unlike Iraq, that was pieced together by the Sykes-Picot Treaty. Iran was here for a long, long time. And that's part of the difference. They've got a very proud history, and they're a proud people with a long history. The Israelis, as we know, are, but they were colonized by the British. But Mossadegh, who was the prime minister, Mossadegh actually went to the Versailles Treaty in hopes of getting the British to end their colonial relation with Iran back in 1919. As we know, they weren't any more successful than was Ho Chi Minh or some of the others who wanted the world to repudiate colonialism after World War I. Israel was founded much later, in 1948. And Israel was really largely in response, although you could go back to the Balfour Declaration, when the British effectively made a commitment to a Jewish state in Palestine, even though the territory was overwhelmingly Arab and Muslim and not Jewish. But after the Holocaust, the world so sympathized with the Jewish people that many countries allowed for the creation of Israel. And initially, it's interesting that the first two countries to recognize Israel were the United States and the Soviet Union. So Israel, a lot of the early settlers were socialists and communists, and it wasn't quite clear which way Israel was going to lean. We know that as things evolved, Israel became an important part of U.S. foreign policy in the region, the real U.S. outpost in the region. But that wasn't entirely apparent when Israel was first founded. Now, the U.S., I think what you're referring to with Iran was the U.S. hand in overthrowing the Mossadegh government in 1953.
Yes.
Mossadegh was a fiercely nationalist and enormously popular, democratically elected ruler of Iran. But
relatively secular, I believe. I mean, we're not talking about an Islamic nationalist. We're talking about a secular, democratically elected government.
Right. Iran doesn't become a theocracy until the CIA overthrows Mossadegh in 1953. But in 50 earlier in the decade, when Truman was in power, the Iranian parliament voted unanimously to nationalize Anglo-American Oil Company, which was the forerunner of British Petroleum. So the British controlled the oil industry in Iran, which was provided 40% of the world's oil supply at that point.
40%. I mean, it's incredible. I mean, yeah. That's, I didn't know that figure. It's extraordinary.
And so the under Mossadegh, the Iranians nationalized it. Iran was getting almost nothing from British Petroleum. British Petroleum was paying Iran 16 cents on the dollar, where Saudi Arabia made a deal with Aramco, in which Aramco was paying Saudi Arabia 50 cents on the dollar. So that gave more incentive to the Iranian parliament to nationalize the oil industry. The British were not in a very good position to challenge that because Britain had already nationalized much of its industry. So the British, under the Labour government after World War II, had nationalized big parts of the British economy. However, the British intelligence began planning a coup to overthrow Mossadegh. The American ambassador wrote back to Washington that, well, this was even a little bit later, under Eisenhower, that Mossadegh was enormously popular, that he had the support of between 95 and 98% of the Iranian people. You have to remember, Mossadegh was Time Magazine's Man of the Year in 1951. He was the national leader. Yeah, he represented the most progressive. He was the first Iranian to get a Doctor of Law degree from a European university. He was the symbol of pride, of Islamic pride throughout the Middle East, and so Truman, who had been planning to support the coup, backed off it. Acheson, among others, did not want to overthrow Mossadegh. But when Eisenhower came to office, they began planning the coup. John Foster Dulles was up to his eyeballs in it, Alan Dulles, and they recruited Kermit Roosevelt.
Just take a step back to describe who the Dulles brothers are for folks that might not know.
The Dulles brothers are the epitome of evil in the 1950s. John Foster Dulles was Secretary of State, and Alan Dulles was the head of the CIA.
I mean, our airport is named after John Foster Dulles, right?
Yes, yes. that's... You know, I always go by the statue and give it the finger when I go to Dulles Airport. and then you got another airport in Washington named after Ronald Reagan. Fortunately,
his first act of office was to fire all the air traffic controllers. Right?
Fortunately, the Baltimore Washington International Airport, is named after Thurgood Marshall.
So, right, but we don't call it Marshall Airport. We call it BWI, unfortunately.
We got one out of three. They've got two out of three. But the Dulles brothers, their law firm back in the 30s, represented a lot of the businesses that continued to operate in Nazi Germany after Hitler took office. They were also up to their eyeballs in doing contracts in Central America. I mean, this is a very, very reactionary, corrupt law firm, and that's what the Dulles brothers were involved in. And that was their claim to fame and power and money. And so when Eisenhower came to office and appointed Dulles, you know, Eisenhower sometimes seemed to be the voice of reason and sanity, and Dulles was the real hardline cold warrior. you know, they, you can make the case that there wasn't really that much separation between them. So it, they decided that they were going to overthrow Mossadegh in 53. And they put Kermit Roosevelt, the chief CIA person, operative in the Middle East, the grandson of Theodore Roosevelt, in charge. They talked about eliminating that madman Mossadegh. The British called him Mussy Duck. And they said he wasn't quite sane. So they began what they called Operation Axis. And the CIA station chief thought this was such an absurd plan that he opposed it, the CIA station chief in Tehran. But the they decided to fire him and go ahead with the operation. So they started spreading rumors that Mossadegh was a communist and a Jew, neither of which was true.
No.
They recruited journalists and clerics and army and police officers and parliament members of parliament and an extremist, a terrorist gang called the Warriors of Islam, and they set them loose in the capital, and they overthrew Mossadegh in 1953.
So, and we should just tell folks that we're setting this up because it's very much connected to the current Islamic Republic government of Iran. This is not just ancient history. It sets up what happens in 1979, and we're very intimately responsible for that. That's why we're going back to 1953. Continue, Professor.
So we overthrow Mossadegh and replace him with the Shah. We had earlier overthrown the British and the Soviets had overthrown the Shah's father because he was a Nazi collaborator. So in 1941, the British and the Soviets overthrew him. And now then they bring back the Shah. And the Shah rules a totally repressive government, no political dissent allowed. He sets up the Savak, the Iranian secret police, which was a brutal repressive force. And they governed for 26 years. And finally, there was the Islamic Revolution in 1979, led by Ayatollah Khomeini. And they put in place the Islamic Revolution in 1979. Khamenei, the current Ayatollah in charge, took over in 1989.
But we should say, Peter, that, you know, that reign of the Shah was pretty notorious. I mean, it was dictatorial. You know, it was a very extraordinarily repressive government that the Iranian people were not happy with, if I'm not mistaken.
Very unhappy with, and very repressive. Under the Shah, and that's why they rebelled in 1979. Unfortunately, instead of the Tudeh Party or the nationalist secular forces, the people who took over were the clerics under Ayatollah Khomeini. And they were very repressive, and they've been very repressive since, a strictly repressive government. You know, I'm no fan of the government of Iran. It's one of the most murderous, backward regimes anywhere on the planet. And they've suppressed, with the help of the Revolutionary Guards, suppressed dissent, treat women as second-class citizens, brutalize women, brutalize their opponents. So if the Iranian people want to rise up and overthrow the Islamic Republic, I'm all for it. I don't want to see the U.S. and Israel overthrow it because there's no good history of regime change at the through the barrel of a gun. You know,
I mean, the gist of it is if the United States and Britain had not intervened in 1953, overthrowing a, I think we can say, secular, democratically elected government and of Mossadegh in 1953, we wouldn't have, if we had not done that in 1953, we would not have created what has been called a blowback of the Islamic Revolution, which has led to the current Islamic government, which is a reactionary, repressive government. And we wouldn't have the situation, I think we can safely say, we don't know. I mean, history is complicated, but we wouldn't have the repressive theocratic government that we have now in Iran. And I think that's important. We don't, you know, we don't consider the consequences of our actions. And then it goes to Israel too. You know, we were very instrumental in supporting the creation of the Jewish state in 1948. And now we have these two actors, you know, acting against each other. I mean, we often don't understand the consequences of our actions. I mean, you know, look at Vietnam. You know, with all this horrible communist threat, now they're a major trading partner. I mean, it's just we don't understand what we're doing on the international stage. I think it's safe to say we don't think about long-term consequences.
I think you would say that even more about the Trump administration than you would about some of the other administrations. Some of the other presidents and their advisors had a long-term strategy for U.S. hegemony and domination and the American empire. Trump flies by the seat of his pants. I mean, he surrounds himself with ignoramuses. I mean, would you want to? He doesn't even take advice from Pete Hegseth. You know, the one person there who has a modicum of decency on occasion, maybe too rare occasion, is Tulsi Gabbard. And she's completely frozen out. I mean, Tulsi and the intelligence community has been insisting that there is no evidence that Iran is committed to developing a bomb, or that if they even wanted to, they could do it quickly. The estimate is that it would take them between months and 2 or 3 years if they committed to developing a bomb before they could have a deliverable bomb. But Netanyahu, there's a very good article in the Washington Post today that talks about, the title is, Netanyahu decided on Iran war last year, then sought to recruit Trump. Then the subhead, the Israeli prime minister had set in motion plans to attack Iran long before President Trump began efforts to resolve nuclear concerns through negotiations, officials say. You know, so people should take a look at that, because that's the reality. This had little to do with Iran dashing to develop a nuclear bomb, which it might now decide to do, if it's still capable, and the evidence seems to suggest that it is still very capable.
Indeed.
But this is a war of choice, as was Trump getting involved and bombing the nuclear sites. But most interesting thing, you know, I assumed that this was going to be like Maggie Thatcher or Bush, it's going to lead to very high approval ratings for Trump. But the CNN poll that came out today shows that the American people are overwhelmingly opposed to this. By 56-44, the American public is opposed to this. Among Democrats, 12% approve the attack and 88% disapprove. Independents, 40% approve and 60% disapprove. So this hasn't even given Trump the bump that he was hoping for, or the Nobel Peace Prize that he was
hoping. Yeah. You know what? This is Community Watch and Comment, and we've got some comments I want to honor and appreciate our folks for calling in. We've got a couple of callers. Let's go to our first call. Your name, if you care to, where you're calling from, and your question or comment.
Yeah, this is T. Berry from Upper Marlboro, Maryland. I heard
Thank
your guest. You're welcome. I heard your guest talking about Iran and the things that happened. I'm an older gentleman, and I wish that I had been educated somewhere else other than the United States sometimes, because I was not aware of a whole lot of things regarding Iran, Lebanon, Israel, or the whole things with Dulles and the whole colonial thing, which they don't educate us about. I have to admit, after watching mainly foreign news media, I have to admire Iran. Unlike Israel, they're not murdering hungry people and starving a whole group and stealing their land and stopping them from working and swimming and fishing and living and moving off of their things.
We're running out of time, so please go to your question.
All right. Question I have is, am I bad for feeling a little bit happy that Iran has enough together to cause Israel to ban any airline from taking more than 50 people, from Israel? And for I wish that the media would inform us what's happening over there. Iran was actually winning, and I'm sorry that it stopped because 400,000 Palestinians probably or more have been killed, and I see people of going for food getting machine gunned and blasted. So I hope that I hear more about the badness of Israel rather than Iran. Both are theocratic states, and both of them, and one is a colonial, vicious, brutal state, and I'm glad that bad stuff is happening to it.
I appreciate you calling. Any thoughts on this, Peter Kuznick?
Well, David, let me first warn you that I have to leave in 4 minutes because I'm doing a CNN interview, a CNN India interview.
You've got to leave in 4 minutes. Okay.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Any thoughts on that?
Are you saying we're being bumped by CNN? How dare you?
CNN India, they're not as bad as CNN here. I don't want to see anybody get hurt in any of those countries. What Israel is doing in Gaza is a crime that is unconscionable. And they've killed, the Lancet says more than 200,000. The official figures that the U.S. uses, maybe 60,000. But you compare that with what the U.S. did in Vietnam. When Robert McNamara came into my class, former Secretary of Defense, who was the brains behind Vietnam, he said that he accepted that 3.8 million Vietnamese died in the war. When I visited Hanoi last year, the Vietnamese leaders tell me that the figure they now use is 5 million died in the war against the United States. So, I mean, what's going on in Gaza is horrible beyond belief. But these things could even be worse. And so I'd rather see these. We need diplomacy. We don't need tit for tat. We don't need retaliation. We don't need military solutions. We don't need the U.S. illegally, unconstitutionally bombing the nuclear sites in Iran. We need to get back to some kind of diplomacy, which has become a dirty word in the United States.
Yeah, that's for sure. So what do you think the outcome is? We've supposedly at the moment have a ceasefire. What do you think the outcome's going to be? I mean, Iran has supposedly secured at least a large part of its enriched uranium and moved to other sites to avoid the attack of the United States. What do you think the outcome's going to be?
I think Iran is in a very weak position. Militarily, they were getting pummeled. They lost control of the skies. Wall Street Journal reported last Friday that Israel was running out of interceptor missiles. So, we don't know where this was going to go. But Iran was clearly the weaker party at this moment. And for a good reason, sued for or accepted a ceasefire. This is a very fragile ceasefire. We don't know if they can resolve this because Iran is going to still insist on its right to enrich uranium. Israel and Trump say no, zero enrichment. So we don't know if they're going to resolve this in any diplomatic way that's going to endure. And as you're saying, Iran was enriching uranium up to 60%. They had close to 900 pounds of enriched uranium. We don't know where that is. The IAEA says they probably moved it, and they've got secret sites. They could still build centrifuges. They can reconstitute their program. I hope they don't. I don't want to see them get a bomb. And if they do get a bomb, then Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Egypt, Turkey will all go rush to develop their own bombs, and we'll have nuclear anarchy in the most dangerous region in the world, or one of the three or four most dangerous regions in the world. But David, I better apologize.
You got to go to another call. I appreciate you. We've been talking to Dr. Peter Kuznick, history professor at American University. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, David, for having me.
Really appreciate it. And I'm sorry, we've got one caller. Maybe you want to voice your comment or your question. I appreciate you calling in. I thought I'd have Dr. Kuznick a bit longer, but please, we'd love to hear from you. Your question or your comment.
If you hear me, yes.
Yeah, okay, Dave, yeah. We hear you. So, thank you for calling in.
Yes. So the way I look at the scenario that's playing out here is if you take the whole thing going back more than a decade to the original agreement with Iran, what was done by diplomacy was to achieve an agreement by them that they could continue to enrich, but as I understand it, but they couldn't build a bomb, and they were under inspection from the international authorities. So what we had there was So what we had there was an agreement for them not to build a bomb. Well, Trump comes in and says, "Oh no, we can't live with that." And so what's ended up is, in the name of peace and in the name of negotiation, where we've ended up is going to war over something. And if Trump succeeds, where we will end up is that in some sort of agreement where they say, we will not build a bomb. Well, wait a second. Isn't that the thing that we already had? You know, did we have to go through all this to get to the same point?
That's an extraordinarily insightful point that you're making. There was a 2015 agreement that President Obama generated that would avoid the creation of a bomb. And in 2018, Trump pulled out of that agreement. And nobody is talking about it. I've been, you know, preparing for the show. I've been reading extensively. Nobody talking about where would we be at if we had just stayed with the Obama agreement.
Well, I heard
in 2015.
Kerry,
you're absolutely right.
But here's the thing that comes out of this is, if the only thing that happens from the current military action is that we end up in the same place we would have been, you know, more than 10 years ago, why did we go through all this to get to the same place? And obviously the reason is that Trump can't live with the idea of negotiating with somebody where the negotiation ends that both parties are pleased with the outcome. To him, negotiation means that you have to achieve some sort of capitulation. So, you know, if you have a negotiation and the Iranians say, okay, we're happy with this and we can live with it, that's not good enough for Trump. What he wants is not negotiation, but capitulation. So we will end up in the same place, but by, you know, it's not good enough to do a negotiation unless it involves humiliation of the other party.
We've got to move on to our. I so much appreciate you calling. Or you could also argue that the problem is that the negotiation was undertaken and completed by Obama. It wasn't Trump's negotiation, and he wanted to be Trump. He wants the Trump brand on it, and I think that's arguably the main concern. But I really appreciate you calling. It's it's nobody's talking about where would we be if Trump had just stuck with the Obama agreement that was created in 2015 that Trump backed out of in 2018. It was my next question for the professor. We didn't have enough time, but thank you so much for calling. Keep listening and really appreciate your very cogent and insightful comment that the mainstream press is not speaking to, at least at this point in time. Thank you so much for calling. And we need to move on to our next guest. We're running out of time. And D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser set a July 15th deadline for the D.C. Council to give preliminary approval for the Washington Commanders' RFK Stadium project, which would mean D.C. funding a new stadium at the site. There is opposition to that deal, needless to say, including from a group called Homes Not Stadiums. And we're joined now by the group's treasurer, Adam Eidinger. Welcome to Community and Watch and Comment, sir.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
It's great having you. And if you can put me on your camera, that would help my impeded hearing abilities, if you could. And welcome to caller 202-588-0893. And Adam, I have to say, I love the background of your shoot here. It's fantastic. I'm not sure what it is. Maybe
I'm trying to answer my door while we're doing this. Just give me one moment.
Yeah, and get as close as to the mic as you can, because your sound is not wonderful. And we'll wait for you. You know, right, we're not television.
Sorry about that. It's an important package. Okay. It just showed
okay.
up.
And Adam, get as close to the microphone as you can so we can hear you clearly. So my first question is, what amount of money would D.C. residents have to pay for this new stadium, this new football stadium?
Well, the mayor is saying it's going to be $850 million, but that's very misleading. That doesn't count the tax breaks that will be afforded to the NFL and the team owners for over 20 years. And it doesn't count, you know, unforeseen costs. I think it's really more like $2 billion in the short term, and more, and then maybe, I don't know, if you listen to Greater Washington, over $14 billion over the life of the deal is essentially being given as a subsidy. Sorry.
Yeah, I mean, are you okay?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm like suffering from COVID. And then I've had this package I've been trying to get for a week now, and the guy just walked into the moment that I got on the air. So now I'm set for the interview. So it's just a lot of money that the public shouldn't be paying for. The owner of the Commanders, Josh Harris, is worth over $11 billion. He's one of the richest.
$11 billion with a B.
Yeah, with a B. He's one of the richest men in the world. Not just in the United States, in the world. And, he owns multiple sports teams. And our mayor has no, guts to stand up to him and say, you know what, you can finance your own stadium. But the more we thought about this deal, the more we thought that, you know, for one, there isn't like there needs to be a stadium to bring the team here. There is a stadium for this team. It's in Landover, Maryland. The Maryland taxpayers have been footing the bill for that stadium for years. And it's not fair to them to just steal the team away after they fought to have the team in Landover. It's also something we don't really need, because everybody calls the Commanders the Washington Commanders, even though they don't play in Washington, D.C. So we really don't need the team to be here to get the credit and the cachet and the – you know, of being a big city with a professional
football. It seems to me that, you know, the New York Giants do not play in New York City. They play in New Jersey. I mean, you can give, you know, I think you could probably say that most football teams do not play in the city that they're named after.
That's it's common, yeah. But, you know, people don't know where Landover is. They've never heard of it outside of this area. But people do have heard of Washington, D.C. The mayor likes to say that we need the stadium there as an anchor to develop the neighborhood. And this couldn't be further from the truth. What we need is a new neighborhood, a real neighborhood, not a neighborhood that's squeezed in between parking garages and a football stadium. I mean, they're proposing an 8,000 car parking garage that will block the view of the stadium for everyone who lives west of where the stadium is going to be. So you won't even see the stadium. It won't even be like you can, oh, look at that beautiful stadium down there. You won't even see it. What you will see is a high-rise parking garage, and that's what the neighbors are going to get. The mayor's plan, you know, talks about housing perhaps as many as 6,000 units of housing will be part of this development deal, as well as recreational sites for the community. But if we were to not build the stadium, if we were to, you know, turn it into a neighborhood, we could be talking about housing for 30,000 people in the same area. And, right. You know, they're under the deal, we can't develop the waterfront. We have to maintain parks. You know, there's only about 100 acres of land that can be developed. But if you were to, the stadium is built, then we're only talking about 20 acres for housing. You know, very little is actually going to end up for housing. So, you know, Homes on Stadiums, you know, we got together realizing we could do a ballot initiative to stop this deal. And we think the voters should have a say in whether or not their tax dollars are going to be given away to a billionaire team owner. And for all the people listening who love the Commanders and, you know, root for them as a hometown team, I'm not insensitive to you. I really like football. You know, I still watch football. It's like the only sport I still watch. So
how dare you admit that, Adam?
Well, I don't watch it that often, but I actually think the sport is losing popularity as someone who's closely followed it my whole life. And we're investing in a dying sport here. You know, we're subsidizing it. I'd rather see subsidies for housing. I'd rather see neighborhoods where a whole wide variety of developers, from small developers to big developers, can bid on land that which the city will receive the money on to develop it. I also think we should be giving first-time homeowners a $100,000 tax credit or even just a subsidy. That so they can get into their homes. People who are, you know, the proposer for this ballot initiative is Chris Furnish. And she's in her 30s, and she wants to have a family in D.C. She makes what people would consider good wages, but in D.C. you can get an efficiency for good wages. You're living in a one room apartment, even though you're making, you know, over $70,000 a year. That's a problem. And so as a result, someone like her, she's saying, look, I won't even start a family in this town because there's nowhere to live. There's no two-bedroom apartments that are affordable. You know, if you want a two-bedroom apartment, you're looking at over $3,000 a month. And more than if someone's making, you know, $70,000 a year, that's more than half their income is going to a rent. And that's not healthy either. I think the standard is about one-third of your income should go to rent. So, yeah, you know, we got to fight this.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, one thing in preparing for this interview that I hadn't quite thought about that I think is extraordinarily important. People see, you know, the National Baseball Team Park and see, hey, this has created a lot of business stuff. But the National Baseball Park and where the basketball team, you know, the Capital Center, whatever it's called now, those are like 80 games a year. But you're talking about with this football stadium, what, 10 events a year with maybe some supplemental events. But it's you know, when you look at Landover, when you look at the area around where the Baltimore Ravens play, where the Philadelphia Eagles play, it's vacuous. It's gloomy. This is not created the business enterprise that's being talked about with the creation of this new stadium. If you talk about that, I think it's extraordinarily important. The difference: this is a football stadium, not a baseball stadium, not a basketball hockey stadium. This is football with very few events a year.
For sure. We're looking at maybe 12 events a year related to the NFL, and that's if they get into the playoffs. Right. Big if.
Which we hope they do. Football. I love football, and I don't think it's a declining sport. I disagree with your
opinion.
Among young
people, it is.
I love football. This is, and we should say that the majority of people in D.C. support the idea of a new stadium. And I think they don't have all the information. We're not talking about not seeing the Commanders. The Commanders are not about to leave the D.C. area. We're just talking about something that's going to make certain folks, richer, money that they don't necessarily need. And it certainly casts questions on our mayor for supporting this. Is this in the best interest of the people of D.C. and the greater D.C. area?
It is absolutely not in the best interest of the people of D.C. to subsidize professional sports, when most of the fans are actually not from D.C. This isn't like this is being a stadium for all the D.C. fans. This is a stadium for Maryland and Virginia, and I always say as far away as Pennsylvania fans who are coming to see these games. And the mayor likes to say, well, it's going to bring revenue into the city and things like that. But all under the deal that she's negotiated, all of the real estate around the stadium will be owned by the team. Okay. This is, and there'll be tax abatements for over 20 years. So this is not going to make money for DC. It's just us paying. So people who are nostalgic about the Redskins and now Commanders playing in the district can feel good that they're back. I just don't think that's a good investment. And the amount of revenue that would be generated from 20,000 to 30,000 new homes in just the property taxes alone will exceed all the revenue that's coming from this stadium. And I just think that the council needs to do due diligence here. They need to really look at this deal versus other alternatives. And Greater Washington has done a great job. I encourage people to get online and check out that news source of just exposing how bad a deal this really is. It's actually the worst deal in the history of stadium deals in the United States. And, I fought very hard against the National Stadium that was being built and what was being proposed in 2004. And, we got that stadium. But because we protested, because people fought that, we ended up getting a better deal. The current deal that we have should be rejected by the DC Council. I predict that this council will not approve this deal by July 15th.
Okay, we should just say from what I'm understanding, this deal probably will be approved. And the deal, from what I understand, means that the Commanders will pay $1 a year, I believe. And we should point out that the Washington Nationals, under the deal that you talked about, pay $6 million a year, I believe, for the opportunity to operate their stadium. And the Commanders are going to pay $1 a year. This does not...
It is a total.
This does not look good for the deal that we're being offered.
It's billionaires stealing the public money. It's theft. And the mayor is involved in this grand larceny. And I predict it's the end of her career, actually. I think this deal is what's going to take her down in the next election cycle if she decides to run again. Maybe she'll go on to be some sort of commissioner at NFL, because I don't understand what's motivating this, Another thing I just want to point out is that we're doing this ballot initiative, which removes the mayor's authority to negotiate and lease the RFK site to a professional sports team. And now we filed this initiative And we had initially as changing the zoning of the site, saying there can't be a stadium there. But, you know, the Attorney General of D.C. and the General Counsel of the Board of Elections basically convinced us that that was not a proper subject matter, that we don't have the authority to change the zoning laws in D.C. through a ballot initiative. So we went back to the drawing board and we came up with a more direct approach, which is removing the mayor's authority to negotiate a deal with the NFL. Just she won't be able to do it. Now, we filed this and we will be before the Board of Elections on August 8th, where we will find out if it's a proper subject matter. If the council doesn't approve the funding before then, before August 8th, we believe that actually we've preempted them. And even though this wouldn't be voted on until November of 2026, it would still be retroactively enforceable. And that alone just should scare Josh Harris and the Commanders away from making this deal, which a year later could just be killed because the voters decide to kill it. And, you know, the polling that's been done in the Washington Post shows about 53% of Washingtonians just straight out support this deal based on an $850 million price tag. Which is misleading because that is not the price tag. The price tag is much higher than that, between $2 billion and $14 billion over the life of the agreement. So I think when people realize that it's actually a worse deal, I think support will drop. And so Homes Not Stadiums is, you know, getting the word out, and we're building a coalition. We were also working with a group called No Playgrounds for Billionaires, which is made up of the neighborhood right around the stadium. It's being led by the ANC commissioner in that area. And, you know, I think there's a really powerful tool here to assert a democratic process, to assert the will of the people, and that is to let the people vote on this deal. And the last thing I want to say is the council could just put this on the ballot too. They could say, we're not going to approve this deal until the voters sign off on it. It's just too big of a deal, too much money. But they probably won't do that. But I, you know, our count of council members and where they stand on this issue, my understanding is that most of them do not support the current deal. And I don't think it's going to be approved on July 15th. And I think there's consequences for any political leader who supports this. I think they will find out that the public is not okay with giving away billions of dollars to billionaires.
Any recommendations for what folks can do that are listening that you know, are questioning this deal? What do you recommend they do?
So, I think people should. First of all, I think people should go to our website, homes.stadiums.org, and check out, you know, the actual ballot initiative text, what we're proposing, and then sign up. And then, you know, we're educating the public. We're hanging up over 2,000. Large posters over DC, all over DC right now, because we want to engage the community that actually there's people standing up to this and who don't want this, and you should join us. I think that's basically where we're at. I mean, this is going to be a slow process to fight this through a ballot initiative, but I've personally, you know, worked on four major ballot initiatives in DC since 2014, and they've all passed, and you know, they've all become law to some extent. So I'm a big believer in this process. You know, we only have one branch of government in D.C. We only have one council. You know, we don't have two branches of legislative branch. Well, the other legislative branch is the people doing direct democracy through ballot initiatives. That's the way we can check the council and check the mayor. And that was built into the Home Rule Act, and we should take advantage of it. So we're taking advantage of it now. And you know, I think if you put this in the hands of the people and then they decide they want it, they actually do want to give the money away and build the stadium, fine. I will accept that. But I actually think that is not what's going to happen. If the public had a choice, they would vote not to fund this. Lastly, I don't think we would be doing this ballot initiative if the team was proposing to pay its own way, to pay its fair share. Any business owner in D.C., would love to get a subsidy for their business, and they don't get them. So why should the richest business people get it
right, when
small businesses don't get this?
I understand your point. We're out of time, and It's great having you and speaking with Homes Not Stadiums treasurer Adam Eidinger. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
Really appreciate it. And that's going to do it for our show. Thanks to Mike Nocella for his extraordinary help of getting us through the show. It was not easy. Coming up, we've got Don't Forget the Blues with Lady Murr, the extraordinary Lady Murr. And thank you for listening. I'm Dave Rabin. Stay safe and have a good week.
Education, art, health, music, politics, and all things community.
Yes!
Join me, Ambrose Lane Jr., as we uncover the issues of D.C. communities east of the river on To the East, Mondays at 5 p.m. right here on your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW 89.3 FM.
The WPFW Local Station Board's Relocation Committee is in the process of re-envisioning what studio space for a progressive, community-based, and community-supported radio station should be in the coming decade or more. We wish to ensure that a new, more permanent home will meet current needs and those less foreseeable in the future. All WPFW stakeholders, listeners, donors, programmers, staff, community activists may share their thoughts and insights about the future space by taking the location survey located on the WPFW homepage. Be creative in your answers. The future belongs to those who dream big. The survey may be found at www.wpfwfm.org. Please submit your answers by June 30th. Thank you for your thoughts and time.
On Monday, June 30th, WPFW presents The House That Wanda Built 2025, our annual Pride special programming. From 2 p.m. until midnight, WPFW will broadcast voices from the Inside Out Collective and beyond, discuss issues affecting the LGBTQIA+ community, and present music from the Anthology of Booty and the Ladies' Room, honoring the life and legacy of Washington, D.C.'s beloved Black lesbian activist Wanda Alston. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Code Pink, Women for Peace, is coming to you live from Washington, D.C. and New York City, Thursday at 11 a.m. Code Pink Radio is an energizing new program focused on ending wars and militarism and building a peace economy. Listen weekly to robust conversation and inspiration from grassroots peacemakers from places like Korea, Yemen, Venezuela, Palestine, and Iran, as well as peacemakers in our nation's capital who are confronting war hawks in the White House and in Congress and modeling the actions we want our government to take. Again, that's Code Pink Radio, Thursdays at 11 a.m. on Washington, D.C.'s WPFW and New York City's WBAI, an engaging hour of cutting-edge conversation not to be missed.
We are women of the world. We're from the east, south, north, and west.
Greetings. WPFW is pleased to announce the relaunch of our major donor program, now known as the Jazz and Justice Circle. If you gave $1,000 last year or so far this year, you are automatically enrolled in this cherished group of listener members, and we thank you. Benefits of your membership are at wpfwfm.org under the Support Us tab at the top of the homepage is the Jazz and Justice Circle. Interested in joining this select group? Please consider a donation of $1,000 or more online at wpfwfm.org. Your donation helps WPFW build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Welcome to The Collision.
The Collision, where sports and politics smash, Thursdays at 10 a.m. and on iTunes and Google Play. WPFW, Washington, D.C.
WPFW, Washington.